From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. After revelations emerged Thursday from the Associated Press that the U.S. Agency for International Development had developed a massive clandestine program using text messaging to incite a rebellion in their country, Cuban officials issued a statement condemning the program as another instance of U.S. interference in its internal affairs in violation of international law. White House Press Secretary Jay Carney admitted to the details of the program after the recent disclosure by the AP of its existence, and he said it was not unique to Cuba, but he denied that the operation is or was a covert one.
We've seen the story by the AP this morning. The program referred to by the Associated Press was a development program run by the United States Agency for International Development, and that program was completed in 2012. As you know, USAID is a development agency, not an intelligence agency. Suggestions that this was a covert program are wrong. Congress funds democracy programming for Cuba to help empower Cubans to access more information and to strengthen civil society. These appropriations are public, unlike covert action. The money invested has been debated in Congress. In addition, GAO reviewed this program in detail in 2013 and found that it was conducted in accordance with U.S. law and under appropriate oversight controls. In implementing programs in non-permissive environments, of course the government has taken steps to be discreet. That's how you protect the practitioners and the public. This is not unique to Cuba. So more details about the program are available at USAID, and I think that veterans of this briefing room know that when I say a program like this is not covert and then I talk about it, that's how you know it's not covert, because I'm talking about it.
We'll have more on that and a discussion with Tony Solo, our reporter from south of the border, later in the newscast. Brussels police used tear gas and water cannons in clashes with protesters as thousands gathered at a trade union rally against austerity. Violence in the area caused a lockdown at the U.S. Embassy. More than 25,000 people marched against austerity and unemployment, representing trade unions from across the EU, who followed a call from the European Trade Unions Confederation to the first Euro manifestation for the year. Participants demanded what they called a new way for Europe, and they were faced with a heavy-handed police response. In reply, some demonstrators threw oranges and cobblestones at police. Violent clashes also took place near the U.S. Embassy. The trade unions are demanding an economic policy that involves, quote, no austerity, but big investment aimed at steady economic growth and quality jobs, closed quote. That, according to organizers. Demonstrators urged EU voters to choose candidates that will change the order of governing the EU in European elections set for late next month. Friday marked the 65th anniversary of NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, set up at the height of the Cold War as an alliance of the U.S., Canada, and Western Europe in opposition to the former Soviet Union. Some wonder if NATO should be retired as it turns 65. We have this from RT.
It's exactly 65 years since the world's largest military alliance was formed. For decades, NATO was the Western world's joint defense against a Cold War enemy. But with those days long gone, are its mission and huge budget still justified? Anastasia Chalkina finds out.
NATO, just a dozen countries set it up in 1949 as a defense mechanism against the Soviet Union. Fast forward 65 years, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization is a military alliance of 28 members and counting.
It's pretty clear a violation of an agreement that was made between the United States and former Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev in 1990 that said at the time that NATO promised not to even go into East Germany, much less any further east than Germany. The U.S. has more than violated that agreement.
Combined, NATO members account for a lion's share of the world's military spending.
Since then, in the last 65 years, NATO's done not one good thing. What has it done?
For starters, there's the war in Afghanistan that's seen the U.S. conduct the longest-running war in its own history. The only clear result so far is that the country is in a mess. The 1999 bombings of Yugoslavia, hundreds of civilians dead and injured, including children, all under the auspices of a humanitarian mission.
Headed by the United States, fundamentally illegitimate, unjust, and essentially immoral.
In 2003, the devastating invasion of Iraq, spearheaded by the U.S. and its faithful ally Britain. Cue years of insurgency and a skyrocketing number of deaths through terror attacks. In 2011, the Libyan campaign that turned a no-fly zone operation into full-scale military support for the rebel forces.
If you look at NATO's role there, it is so far from its professed role of providing security to its member states. It had nothing to do with that at all. That was basically an aggressive action against another country.
The alliance's stated objective is collective defense.
Every country agrees that an attack on one is an attack on all the others. It's like mountain climbers where they're all attached to one another, and if one falls, they all fall.
While that's the deal on paper, in reality, not a single NATO member has ever been attacked by another country. The U.S. bankrolls the alliance, paying over 70% of its budget and urging reluctant European members to stump up their fair share.
The United States' use of NATO is just to expand its own power as, you know, a world empire, even though that term is passé.
The only protection against international law for NATO is the fact that its principal anchoring organization is the United States and the Pentagon, and because of its vast economic and political power, it shields itself from criminal culpability. Otherwise, NATO generals would be in The Hague in front of the International Criminal Court facing charges.
The organization marks its anniversary amidst ongoing questions about the need for its existence. Its initial enemy gone, its mission redundant. 65 years since NATO's inception, the world has changed and is increasingly moving towards multilateralism. But NATO, spearheaded by the U.S., refuses to accept the new geopolitical realities of the modern day, continuing to flex its muscles and to try to spread its wings further. Anastasia Churkina, RT, Washington, D.C.
Some analysts claim NATO has become merely a branch of U.S. foreign policy, with Washington's economic interests ultimately determining the course the alliance takes.
I am all for international law. I think we badly need it if we want to live in a world of peaceful coexistence. But the question is, what is left of international law after 65 years of interventions, dozens of interventions in the internal affairs of other countries, and of a series of illegal wars? What the United States needs is a world where its multinational corporations have privileged access to the world's markets for their products and capital export, and of course also control of the world's energy resources and raw materials. And war and the threat of war has always been one of the means through which the United States secured this access to markets and resources, and NATO has always been one of the tools of this policy.
So let's have a look at how much money is being poured into the alliance. Despite limited cuts in recent years, NATO defense spending accounts for more than half of the global total. At over $1 trillion, it far outstrips those of the powers most often portrayed as potential threats. Russia's annual defense budget is a mere $90 billion. And recently, Washington has been urging European allies to further increase their contributions, warning that their security is at stake. Well, NATO has been using the ongoing crisis in Ukraine as a justification for those warnings, beefing up its forces close to Russia's borders. The alliance also froze ties with Russia in the wake of its reunification with Crimea, and that's blocked key areas of security cooperation, as RT's Gianni Chikian explains.
The referendum in Crimea and its subsequent becoming part of Russia has opened the floodgate of fear-mongering against Russia. NATO's several rounds of post-Cold War expansion did not make much sense to a lot of people, especially given how much tension it added to relations with Russia, which saw the military alliance coming closer and closer to its borders. This week, Secretary of State John Kerry delivered a speech celebrating post-Soviet NATO enlargement, talking about what a success it has been. So in light of all this, the U.S. is beefing up its presence in Eastern Europe, sending fighter jets to the Baltic states, a warship to the Black Sea, and planning new war games near Russian borders. The Ukrainian parliament has approved a series of joint military exercises with NATO countries. Ukraine had held exercises with NATO before, but there's indication that they may expand. Moscow says it has no intention to invade anyone, but that does little to assuage Western rhetoric.
The United States will try, as it has in the past, to persuade its members to spend more on military investment. I just don't think that's going to happen. And the reason I don't think it's going to happen is that they are in poor economic shape. They can only invest in military power at the expense of their welfare states. And I don't see much evidence for anyone's willingness to do that at this point.
The U.S. and NATO officials are using the tension with Russia to bolster the alliance. But at the same time, they don't want the rhetoric to get in the way of the benefits that they've been getting from Russia, like cooperation on Afghanistan. Russia had for years provided transit for NATO's Afghanistan-bound cargo. And just on the heels of the announcement that NATO was suspending ties with Moscow, NATO's chief said they're still expecting Russia to cooperate on Afghanistan. So confusing statements like that should not come as a surprise when NATO and its key member, the U.S., is trying to rip all benefits that a crisis can offer.
As we reported yesterday, a freak combination of weather conditions has left parts of England covered in a smog haze made up of high levels of particles, including red dust from a sandstorm in the Sahara Desert. Air pollution levels remained high across parts of England and Wales on Friday, but were expected to reduce later in the day as a fresh air mass was expected to push the pollution eastward over the North Sea, that according to local weather forecasts. London experienced very high levels of pollution, the highest levels recorded by authorities. The Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs reported early Friday that more than 20 areas from northern England down to the southeast were still gripped by high levels of pollution Friday morning. Ambulance services reported a rise in emergency calls Thursday as air quality plummeted across the UK. Kay Boycott, chief executive of Asthma UK, said that two-thirds of people with asthma find air pollution makes their condition worse. She said asthma takes the lives of three people in the country every day.
Good evening. Dr. Martin Luther King, the apostle of nonviolence in the civil rights movement, has been shot to death in Memphis, Tennessee. Police have issued an all-points bulletin for a well-dressed young white man seen running from the scene. Officers also reportedly chased and fired on a radio-equipped car containing two white men. Dr. King was standing on the balcony of a second-floor hotel room tonight when, according to a companion, a shot was fired from across the street. In the friend's words, the bullet exploded in his face. Police, who have been keeping a close watch over the Nobel Peace Prize winner because of Memphis' turbulent racial situation, were on the scene almost immediately. They rushed the 39-year-old Negro leader to a hospital where he died of a bullet wound in the neck. Police said they found a high-powered hunting rifle about a block from the hotel, but it was not immediately identified as the murder weapon. Mayor Henry Loeb has reinstated the dusk-to-dawn curfew he imposed on the city last week. Governor Buford Ellington has called out 4,000 National Guardsmen. In a nationwide television address, President Johnson expressed the nation's shock.
America is shocked and saddened by the brutal slaying tonight of Dr. Martin Luther King. I ask every citizen to reject the blind violence that has struck Dr. King, who lived by nonviolence.
Dr. King had returned to Memphis only yesterday, determined to prove that he could lead a peaceful mass march in support of striking sanitation workers, most of whom are Negroes. Dr. King had this to say last night about the situation in Memphis.
Maybe I could understand the denial of certain basic First Amendment privileges because they haven't committed themselves to that over there. But somewhere I read of the freedom of assembly. Somewhere I read of the freedom of speech, somewhere I read. Of the freedom of press, somewhere I read. That the greatness of America is the right to protest far right.
Friday marked the 46th anniversary of the murder of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in Memphis, Tennessee, as he was preparing to join a massive labor strike in the city, 1 year to the day that he announced the joining of the anti-war and civil rights movements by declaring at Riverside Church in New York that the U.S. government was the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today. Minutes after his assassination, Senator Robert Kennedy spoke at a campaign rally in the rain on a basketball court in Indianapolis.
I have some very sad news for all of you, and I think sad news for all of our fellow citizens and people who love peace all over the world. And that is that Martin Luther King was shot and was killed tonight in Memphis, Tennessee. Martin Luther King dedicated his life to love and to justice between fellow human beings. He died in the cause of that effort. In this difficult day, in this difficult time for the United States, it's perhaps well to ask what kind of a nation we are and what direction we want to move in. For those of you who are black, considering the evidence evidently is that there were white people who were responsible, you can be filled with bitterness and with hatred and a desire for revenge. We can move in that direction as a country in greater polarization. Black people amongst blacks and white amongst whites, filled with hatred toward one another. Or we can make an effort, as Martin Luther King did, to understand and to comprehend and replace that violence, that stain of bloodshed that is spread across our land, with an effort to understand compassion and love. For those of you who are black and are tempted to be filled with hatred and mistrust of the injustice of such an act against all white people, I would only say that I can also feel in my own heart the same kind of feeling. I had a member of my family killed, but he was killed by a white man. But we have to make an effort in the United States. We have to make an effort to understand, to get beyond or go beyond these rather difficult times. My favorite poem, my favorite poet was Aeschylus. And he once wrote, "Even in our sleep, pain which cannot forget falls drop by drop upon the heart, until in our own day despair, against our will, comes wisdom through the awful grace of God." What we need in the United States is not division. What we need in the United States is not hatred. What we need in the United States is not violence and lawlessness, but is love and wisdom and compassion toward one another, and a feeling of justice toward those who still suffer within our country, whether they be white or whether they be black.
At the time, Kennedy was running for president on an anti-war, pro-civil rights platform. 2 months and 2 days later, he met a similar fate. Throughout her 6 terms in the U.S. Congress, former Congressional Representative Cynthia McKinney investigated the death of Dr. King, using her position as a member of the House to obtain access to hidden files detailing the FBI's long-term surveillance and harassment campaign against him. In a 2011 appearance on Iranian television, she pointed out that the assassinations of King, Malcolm X, and the Kennedys put a halt to a converging of the anti-war, civil rights, and labor movements that appeared to herald a sea change in American policy at the time.
Those who have worked very hard for peace, there was a time when we almost won. We almost won in the 1960s. But unfortunately, because we were so close to winning, the authorities fought back. We were so close to winning, and then they killed John Kennedy, our president. They killed Malcolm X. They killed Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
They were killed by the authorities?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. This is all documented. The COINTELPRO papers, the counterintelligence program papers, document the history of U.S. government, efforts to quash dissent. And in the founding document, which was written April 4th, 1967, the U.S. government said that they wanted to misdirect or otherwise neutralize certain leaders in the black community, the Latino community, the Mexican American community, the Puerto Rican independence movement, the American Indian movement, all of these various organizations. You could say they were liberation organizations. They all came together in the 1960s and 70s. So that's when we were almost there. We had almost won so that we could change the United States. And then, as I said, the leadership of these organizations were targeted. They were put in prison. Their marriages were dissolved. All of this is available publicly on the internet, all of these papers. And so the movement for peace and justice and equality in the United States just kind of became decimated. So now, what is it that we need today in order to revive what we had, that spirit that we had? We have particular work to do inside the United States. And we need a peace movement. But as I always say, whose revolution gets funded? The other side, the people who want to deny human rights, human dignity, the warmongers, their revolution is always financed. So if we could organize in such a way so that we could bring back the spirit of resistance inside the United States that we once had, organize it, finance it, mobilize it, I think we'd go a long way to having peace.
After revelations emerged Thursday that the U.S. Agency for International Development had developed a massive clandestine program using text messaging to incite a rebellion in their country, Cuban officials issued a statement condemning the program as another instance of U.S. interference in its internal affairs in violation of international law. According to documents obtained by the Associated Press and multiple interviews with the people involved, the U.S. government, working through the USAID, planned to build a network of Twitter-style contacts in Cuba to create protests intended to undermine the government there. In reply to the disclosures, the following statement was issued through the Cuban newspaper Granma. Quote, "The information contained in the article by the U.S. agency AP confirms the repeated complaints of the Cuban government. It shows once again that the U.S. government has not given up its subversive plans against Cuba, which aim to create situations of destabilization in the country, to bring about change in our political system, and to which it continues to devote multi-million dollar budgets each year. The U.S. government must respect international law and the purposes and principles of the Charter of the United Nations and, therefore, cease its illegal and covert actions against Cuba, which are rejected by the Cuban people and international public opinion." Closed quote. We discussed the revelations from the Associated Press with Tony Solo, our reporter from south of the border, who spoke with us from Managua, Nicaragua. So, big news, this revelation about the U.S. Op against Cuba with the cell phones.
Yeah, it is quite important news, in the sense that it confirms what so many of us already knew about the way U.S. used by the U.S. government to implement covert operations against legitimate governments.
Which is exactly what it's not supposed to do.
Right. And the USAID is supposed to be a development outfit, and most of their programs generally fit into the development program of the country concerned and are negotiated together with the country concerned.
Right. And instead, let's lay out the facts of this revelation. It was broken by the Associated Press, no less. And an interesting part of that is the history. It was a year or two ago when the Associated Press found out that, in fact, they had been spied upon by the Obama administration, the NSA, and whomever, who were trying to figure out how they put their stories together. They were, inside the editor's room and, spying on them to see how they put their product together. So the fact that they broke this is interesting. I wonder if it's a gotcha.
Well, who knows, Don? And the nitty-gritty with this illegitimate use of the United States Agency for International Development to fund what are, in effect, spying operations or psychological warfare operations. And that's all. In some ways, looking at it, the most important thing is that they've become much more blatant about how they do it. Because if the AP can come up with that information, it might well have been, for example, just off the top of my head, it might well have been a case of, well, we'd better get this information out before the Cubans do. Mm. Something along those lines, who knows.
But
and just over the last year or so, in Venezuela, of course, and I think it's Bolivia, and also in Ecuador, in all those countries, the USAID has come in for very serious scrutiny as a result of its activities by its officials in those countries that went far beyond the bounds of legitimate development cooperation programs. I think it was Venezuela expelled, I think it was three USAID functionaries, including a woman called, I think it was Kaling, who herself had previously had a very high-level post in Cuba, where she was responsible for precisely the kind of program that is being exploited in Venezuela to create havoc and destabilize the country there.
Yeah, clearly the USAID... people are working hand in glove with the CIA and presumably the local military with the revelations about the senior officers last week in Venezuela.
And of course they do. One of the constant characteristics of U.S. government policy, in particular in the area of foreign affairs, is that they follow the kind of gangster dictum: don't let your left hand know what your right hand's doing.
Right.
And so what you'll get with in countries here in Latin America are very worthwhile programs promoted by USAID, run by very committed, genuine, sincere people. I here in Nicaragua, I have great admiration for some of the people that I've met working in a very committed way on USAID programs.
Right.
But the problem is that their activities, their genuine bona fide development cooperation activities, take place within an administrative and managerial and policy framework that is designed for completely other ends.
Right.
And of course, there's a strong element of the way in which programs to develop local agriculture or programs to improve local healthcare and local education provide an alibi for much more questionable, suspicious, and downright sinister activity.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.